Today is August
15th,
1985. I'm Mark Wagler, talking with Halsey Reinhardt at his home in Rockbridge, Wisconsin. Several stories about Mr. Hatch. The one about working in Sunday, the other one about the fishing poles.
Well, Mr. Hatch was a good Christian man and a very pious man, not uncomfortably so, but certainly his belief in God and his belief in the Bible meant that the Sabbath was a day of rest. And we were astounded one Sunday to observe Mr. Hatch busily working out in the bee yard with his wheelbarrow and his smoker and his bee veil on, wheeling in hives of bees into his room where he extracted the honey, and just working busily away. And my dad, having gone to church probably and was dressed up after church, wandered out in the afternoon and wondered why Mr. Hatch was busily extracting honey. But along about 4 o'clock, the extractor broke, and he, having to go out across our backyard in order to get up to the village, he came out carrying a piece of his extractor and said, "Well, I'm just going to take this up and have Charlie Anderson weld it." And Dad said, "Well, I'm sure Charlie isn't up in the shop today. I don't think he'll want to weld that today. This is Sunday, Mr. Hatch." "Oh, no, this is Saturday." And Dad said, "Well, Mr. Hatch, this is Sunday." "Oh, it just can't be." And he just waved his hand, and he wasn't convinced at all, and he took his piece of extractor up to Charlie Anderson, and Charlie said, "Well, just lay it there by the door, and I'll take it over to the shop, and the first thing tomorrow morning, well, I'll fix it for you." "Oh, I don't want you to fix it on Sunday." "Well, but Charlie said, Mr. Hatch, this is Sunday." Well, with two bits of evidence, it began to get through to him that it just might be Sunday. And I don't know what else he did to collaborate the finding of the teachings of these two men that it was Sunday, but he came back, and he was so pious, and he was so hurt. Here he had worked all day Sunday. So the next day, being Monday, we saw Mr. Hatch sitting out in the shade by his little house with his Sunday clothes on, sitting out in his rocking chair reading his Bible. And I'm sure that every little while he looked up and said, "Lord, just forgive me this time. I'll never do it again." Of course, Mr. Hatch was always an attendant down at the Buck Creek Church. That was a United Brethren church, and both Mr. Hatch and his wife had been United Brethren ministers, and it had a great many different congregations in their lives. Mr. Hatch was a very faithful member of our congregation, and of course we rode to church with him and to Sunday school many times in his Model T Ford, because my dad didn't always go, and my mother didn't drive at that time, and so we would ride with Mr. Hatch when he went to church. But this particular Sunday that I'm referring to, we had gone on ahead with our 26 Chevy and were in church when Mr. Hatch came in late. And church was already started, and Mr. Hatch just busily bustled right up to the front and took his place in the pew where he always sat, and opened his hymnal and started singing in that terrible off-key voice of his, in which he sometimes sang a verse all by himself after everybody else had finished the verses that were there, because he'd started in on the wrong verse and thought that he was right in collaboration and harmony with everybody else and sang at least half a verse by himself. But anyway, Leonard Jackson, who was sort of amused by things of this caliber, came to church late also, and he came in just grinning from ear to ear, and he went up and he got by Mr. Hatch, and he whispered to Mr. Hatch. Mr. Hatch straightened up, and he looked so astounded, and what Leonard had said to him was that, "Mr. Hatch, do you know that you've parked your car right in front of the church door with the fish poles on the side?" This being Sunday, there was no way that Mr. Hatch want to be mistaken as having stopped into church on his way fishing. And so immediately he got up out of his pew and he bustled out and he took those fish poles off and he took them out of the church, and or took them off of the car and out back of the church and laid them along the fence and didn't even come back and pick them up until Monday morning.
Any other stories that come to mind about the church, about the church, or even about closing of the church?
Well, that churches grow on people about income in comparison with the amount of effort they put in them. And the Buck Creek Church had just got along with just a very few members for years and years and years. And sometimes they'd been on the verge of closing, and they were shared this circuit with Gillingham and English Ridge, so that the minister would have three charges to preach at on Sunday morning and evening, and we were the low end of the charges. But then about 1940, we were without a minister, and Lester Matthews, who was clerk in a hardware store, James's Hardware Store in Richland Center, came out one Sunday morning to substitute for a minister. And the people liked him, and he liked it, and he came and said, "Well, if you don't have somebody by next Sunday, I'll come back next Sunday." And that went on for 25 years. And Lester Matthews was a genius in getting people to do the things that they didn't think that they were able to do. He would say, "Well, now, we don't really expect you to be perfect in what you do, but you just do the best you can, and that's all the rest of us are doing. And if you do the best that you can, why, we'll be happy." And somehow or other, he reached people, and the church began to build, and more people came, and eventually, why, they decided it would be a good thing to have a basement in the church, because one of the things that had kept the Buck Creek Circuit alive for many years was the Ladies' Aid, and they put on the Ladies' Aid Society dinners for elections. The election dinner was an event always, primary election and general election and a spring election and town meeting. All the elections, the Ladies' Aid put on a meal, and so it would be nice to raise the church up and put a basement under. So we started in digging out from under the church, and we dug out from under the church. I took my little tractor down, and men came and helped dig that had never been to church before, and they joined into the fellowship, and they came back on Sunday, and the church just really prospered. And we put the basement under there, and put tables down there, and drove a pump, and so that we had water in the basement, and it was a very, very successful enterprise. And one of the things, we did have water in the basement because the big high water came up and just rushed right in the basement windows and filled the basement until the table and chairs and the cabinets upset and spilled the dishes all out on the floor. And this happened a couple different times, and we had to install sump pumps and clean it out. But the more of those enterprises that you have in which the neighborhood enters into as a group, the more successful you are. And then we decided, well, we really needed more Sunday school room. So we started in planning an addition to the church for Sunday school room. Well, we found out that when you start adding to churches, that the churches belong they belong to the conference. And you have to go through conference leads in order to get your church established, to the authority to build to it. And we had a nice plan with a peaked roof on the side of the church and an entryway and all. Well, the church said, "No, you can't do that. We have to have an architect." So the church had an architect, and the architect came out and he said, "Oh, nobody builds that kind of buildings anymore. Those are passé. And so the architect devised a plan with flat roofs. And we had to build the church according to the architect's plan, and that was a flat roof that leaked from the first rain. And it still leaks. There's just no question about it. It just simply leaks. But very, very interesting thing about the building, we just built it on the strength and the power of God, and the fact that maybe God wanted us to build the church. And we had, when we had money, we went and bought cement, and if we didn't have money, why, we borrowed a little money, but then we paid that back. And we went into the woods, and we cut logs, and we dragged the logs out to the roadway, and one of the truckers hauled them to the sawmill, and the sawman, mill man, sawed the logs as his contribution to the church, and we piled the lumber, and then we started digging and digging for the wall, and we were digging down there, and we, it was, just seemed like it was an endless job to dig and form, and there were some of the fellows knew something about it, and up the road came old Tom Hibbard, and Tom was a, his father had been a minister, but Tom was a number one heathen. He had never taken part in any church service at all or a thing. And Tom stopped to see what we're doing, he and his wife. And his wife said, "Tom, you haven't done much for the church. You're a bridge builder and a contractor. Why don't you help him put this wall in?" Tom said, "Well, I'll do that." So the Lord just sent Tom Hibbard and his equipment and truckloads of sand and gravel and the cement mixer. And we dug out and we formed, and in just a few days, we had the wall all in. Where on our own power, without that intervention of divine providence, we would have spent the whole summer building the foundation. As it was, in a couple of weeks' time, we were ready to go moving above that. Well, we were going up building, and the fellows knew, they were amateur carpenters enough to know about what we were doing. And we got up the outside walls up, and the studding up that far, and all, we were ready to put up this flat roof. Well, the contractor, the architect's blueprints called for a truss to be built across out of cross-membered 2x4s and 2x6s, and we were to build this truss across there. And the fellows were all pretty dubious about that truss, because it had to span about 28 feet, and it was going to take, if to get any strength in a truss like that, you were going to have it about 4 feet deep in order to get the strength of the crust brazing. And we were rather reluctant to, we said if we just had a steel beam. And so we were standing out there with our pencils and contemplating starting on making that truss, and we couldn't use our old rough lumber for that. We were going to have to buy newer lumber. And up the road in his Jeep, who did the Lord send but Tom Hibbard. And Tom got way up the road past us, and all at once he turned his little old Jeep around. He come driving back, and he said, "What are you fellas all standing out here? Are you stuck on something?" He said, I just thought you might be stuck. And we said, "Well, the thing of it is, we need a 28-foot steel beam, 14 inches in depth." Tom said, "Well, I've got one." And he said, it's laying down by a bridge down below Richland Center. And he said, "I really can't give it to you, but," he said, I'll deliver it up here for $75. And a new beam of that kind was worth at least $250. And we didn't have the $250 to know where to buy the beam. So the next day, Tom Hibbard, for $75, delivered us the beam that the Lord had sent us, and we went ahead with our building. It just seems just inconceivable that one man was involved in the building of our church so much. And I'm not sure that, well, I'm sure everybody was thankful for him. I don't know whether we ever expressed our thanks to him as deeply as we should, but he should be remembered as having been a great contributor to the building of the addition onto the Buck Creek United Methodist Church. One of the things, of course, always was Bible school. Bible school was every June, and all the larger girls in church were down there helping organize the classes of the younger kids, and there would be from 35 to 70 in Bible school. And we hired a school bus to go up the valleys and come back down and bring kids to the Bible school. And the Bible school and the Bible school program were one of the big events of the year. Another big event of the year was the Large Acre Auction that we would have every fall, in which people would bring in squash and potatoes and pumpkins and flint corn and all those beautiful things. And every once in a while, somebody would bring in a yearling heifer or a steer or a sheep or a pig. And so we had some very, very interesting auctions, and we would take in as much as $1,000 in our large acre auctions in the fall. They were very interesting times.
So why did the church close?
Well, a couple of reasons. Country churches in general were in a difficulty. This wasn't the center of a community. And Lester Matthews, who had come 25 years before, eventually ran down. And he came year after year when he was not capable of really carrying on a good service and wasn't the leader that he had been. But his coming and the people's loyalty to him kept the conference from assigning a newer and younger and more capable minister, and the church began to dwindle until we only had perhaps not over 20 in attendance.
What would it have been?
Oh, I would imagine we probably had 130, probably.
It dwindled from 130 down to 20.
Yeah, down to 20. Yeah, maybe 130 is a high estimate, but there would be 90 people at morning service. And Lester was always calling, leading a men's chorus. You didn't have to be a musician to sing in Lester's chorus. You just had to have lots of volume. And he would organize them. And with a little training, Reverend Guy Kintz came over and helped train us some. And we had a very good men's chorus, and we went around to other churches and sang. It was these community cooperative things that Lester instigated that were the background of the backbone of keeping the church up. And then we decided that we would close the church and join the Richland Center Church. Of course, you were free to join who you wanted to, but our church pretty well en masse, with the exception of a couple of families who went up to Bloom City to church because they were a little closer. We moved en masse into Richland Center. And a small church is a beautiful thing in comparison to a large church, because everybody has to work. If the small church functions, there are more leaders in proportion than there are in the big church. And the people from Buck Creek who went into Richland Center to church in a very short time were teaching Sunday school classes in Richland Center, and they just simply integrated right into the Richland Center system very well. But it was a heartbreaking thing for me to leave the church. My daughters and my wife and my mother and I and my father and my grandfather had all gone to that church, and it was just a part of our being. That was all there was to it. We had contributed to every nail that was involved and every bit of the program. And then suddenly we were out going to Richland Center, and I thought, I just never will be able to drive past that church on Sunday morning and see it sitting there vacant and nobody there. No fire, no smoke coming out of the chimney. This is going to be terrible. Well, the Lord takes care of those things. And the first day into Richland Center was the most terrible snowstorm that you had ever seen. And when I drove the church wasn't even visible from the highway. The swirling snow, so I was too busy driving, and I didn't even see the church. And I guess by the next Sunday, my sorrow had sort of eased. And we were very happy, though, that the Mennonite people came and bought the church from us. For them it was nice because the church was equipped with a good furnace room and a good furnace and Sunday school rooms and a basement and the whole bit. And I think probably the total amount that they gave for it was $700 or $800, just a very small amount. And we were so happy that it didn't get filled up with baled hay or somebody stable some pigs in it or something of that kind. And it's still being used at a church. And when I go down to the townhouse to be on the election board and there's somebody over at the church, why, I quite frequently go over and just walk through and relive some of the memories and re-see in my memory some of the people and the pews that they sat in, and visualize the church as it was when I was there.
Well, Do you know anything about the founding of the church, your connections or any family connections to that?
Yes, I know a little about it. An old minister whose name was John Turgeson, and I remember him well in about 1928 or 9, because he had a 28 or 9 Ford that he drove when he came to our church sometimes, and he always wore a stand-up collar, a minister's stand-up collar, not reversed, but without a tie. And Brother John Turgeson had, Judd Coffern, one of the old ministers, had held revival service in the townhouse in about 18, when Gyneth gets here I could tell you the exact date because she knows, but probably about 1884. And one of the men had, in a letter had written, well, I made a contribution today because I gave the land up at Buck Creek for the new Buck Creek Church. So somebody had contributed the land. I think Austin's, I think, probably were the name of the people who had contributed the land. And then the church, this is the original church. I don't think any church preceded this except the church services that were held in the townhouse.
What other churches are there in Rockbridge?
There never has been a church in Rockbridge. There was a lot of question about building a church here and giving money to build the church, and my dad always said, well, I'll contribute $50, which was big money in those days, toward the building of a church, but I won't give money toward building a community building because I don't think that a community building will serve the area like a church. Well, Dad was a little unpopular because most of the people thought that if you had a community building, you could just as well have church in it besides using it. And their revival services were held many times in the community building and many times in the tent. There were tent services here on the school ground in Rockbridge. But it's been many, many years since there was any church service in Rockbridge. Buck Creek was the church of the area.
Ask again about the Ku Klux Klan. Memories of any particular meeting, conversation?
I can remember my sense of emotional conflict with the coming of the Ku Klux Klan. They were so persuasive and intrusive, and the men that were organizers were very capable, and their doctrines were certainly patriotic to the nth degree, but their concept of acceptance of people of other races and other creeds and other doctrines was very small. They were certainly anti-Jewish, and they were anti-Catholic, and they were anti-Negro, and they were. I characterize them very much like the Nazi ideals. I think when you say that the neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan are in the South, they're very similar. I'm sure they were here, but it's awfully hard to withstand the argumentative efforts of someone who is portraying all the good things of life that you're standing for. You pat yourself on the back and say, yeah, I'm sure for all those things, the open Bible and the flag and all those things, and insidiously into that doctrine is this hatred. Here in Rockbridge, it was an anti-Catholics thing. My dad was a little anti-Catholic, and I'm sure Mr. Hatch had grave doubts about the veracity of Catholic Christians. And there were a couple of families here. One family was Catholic, French Catholic, and the other were Protestants who had fought at every opportunity from the first grade on. And to the anti-Catholics, this just gave a little extra ground and support for the feeling that they had. And I'm sure that their participation in it was largely based on the fact that it was, again, these other Catholics. And I well remember of my uncle, he and I were talking about it the other day, of seeing a couple of men come down the valley carrying a 5-gallon kerosene can and a whole sack of gunny sacks and go across the down below our barn, not coming to the barn or expecting that we would see them, and going on the hill and going back here on top of the hill west of Rockbridge, and right where it would be most obvious to the two Catholic families that lived just above Rockbridge. And I could still find the old remains of the fiery cross that they put up there on the hillside and burned. And I can remember seeing that. And to me as a little boy, it was quite terrifying. I didn't know about it. I didn't know the story of the Ku Klux Klan in the South, so I had no way of associating that horror with it. But it was not contributing to your emotional happiness to see this contradiction and conflict being raised. The meetings,
did you
the meetings.
See that, or did you say that your uncle had seen the can?
My uncle saw them coming across with the can.
Did you see it burning?
Oh yes, I saw it burning, we could only have to walk out here north of the store until you could see where the cross was burning on the high hill, just this side of where we were up at Maryland, up on that high hill and shining across toward Rockbridge. And the cross itself, when I was later years and went up there and looked at it, it must have been 20 feet high by a 10-foot crossbar on it, or maybe even a 12-foot crossbar on it, and all wrapped with gunny sacks, and the gunny sacks soaked with kerosene, and then the whole thing set on fire. And it would probably burn for 15 minutes before it went out. But there was no questioning the motives of the Klansmen. They were anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish, especially. One of the things that they dwelled on in great sordid lengths was the matter of the celibacy of the nuns and the priests. They simply discounted that entirely, and they pictured that this was a very sexually oriented relationship, and that there were aborted fetuses in the toilets back of the Catholic churches, and this kind of drivel that was the kind that of hate mongering that they thrived on. Dad belonged, Mr. Hatch belonged, and Mr. Hatch had a few questions about it, and my mother made so much fun of my dad, she didn't believe in it at all. And I don't think Dad ever owned a regalia, but I think Mr. Hatch did. And they would, I can remember being in the community building when a visiting Klan came to visit the Klan here at the open meeting, and they marched in with probably 25 white robed and hooded Klan.
Okay, tape one, side two, August 15th, 1985.
I can remember a meeting of the Klan here at Rockbridge when the visiting Klan, I don't know whether it was from Richland Center or Viola or some local area around. I'm sure it wasn't Casnovia. They were predominantly Catholic over there. But the Klan came and they marched in with their robes on and their hoods. And, of course, you never saw their faces. And they had their ritual and the matter of the saluting of the flag. And I guess this is one of the things that has affected my thinking a little bit during my whole lifetime. Is I belong to the Kiwanis Club. Maybe this isn't for publication, but I belong to the Kiwanis, and of course at every Kiwanis meeting we stand erect and salute and pledge allegiance to the flag. And I think I have just a little quiver of that terror that I feel that sometimes we go overboard, and I'm sure that I always qualify my allegiance to the fact that I'm a part of the world. I'm a part of America, and probably none of the men in the Kiwanis Club know American history or American geology or American geography or American culture any better than I do. But, and I think probably if they're better, have a greater allegiance to America than I do, it's a blind allegiance. But I never can pledge allegiance to the flag without qualifying my statement a little bit that a world has to exist over and beyond the United States existing. And that is my gut feeling in the times when I'm asked to pledge allegiance to the flag.
Well, I want to move next to the comment that you made about them supporting McCarthy. Were you active in the statewide Republicans, or was this just Richland County?
Well, it was Richland County, however. We were a part of a statewide organization, and the Young Republicans when there was a statewide Republican convention, Young Republicans met separately and more or less brought in their own opinions to bear on the platform that was to be established by the party, and Joe McCarthy was a county judge over in the Fond du Lac area somewhere, and a very capably appearing young man. And I had heard him as a speaker at the Young Republicans meetings, and he came to our Young Republican meetings and worked quite hard to get Joe McCarthy into the Senate. And seemingly there would be nothing at that time which would indicate that he would become such a violator of human rights as he did later become. If you read the story of Joe McCarthy's life, somebody who was his business manager simply looked around to try and find an issue that would bring Joe McCarthy to the limelight. And they decided that there was nothing more eye-catching than the communist and the anti-communist controversy, and so they decided to pitch Joe right into the anti-communist fray, and he simply went in by accusing everybody of being a communist, and the paranoia caught on and was contagious, and there are still people who I think Joe McCarthy was a great man and did a great job and sorted out all the communists, and he really damaged the reputations and the background of so many good people that it was, I guess probably he became an alcoholic himself, and that was a part of his demise, and he took himself out of the picture.
Can you remember at all your feeling of change about him and how that began to happen?
I guess I always had a little question in my mind as to the terribleness of the communist system. I'm certainly not a communist, and I certainly believe in representative democracy. I think that pure democracy is one of the contemporaries of Plato. Perhaps even Plato said that representative democracy is a good kind of government, but pure democracy very quickly degenerates into anarchy. And I guess probably this is true, but this is a part of my story, I guess. I mentioned Grandpa Halsey Carpenter having a big family of boys, and they're spreading out to the west, somewhere or other in that
great-grandpa
Halsey Carpenter. Somewhere these boys were very progressives. They were socialists. And I was reading a distant cousin sent me a newspaper article written in probably San Luis Obispo about Chauncey Carpenter, who was one of the originators of the governmental unit of San Luis Obispo, California, being always a socialist, always led the socialist parties there. And as a little boy, Uncle Emory Carpenter, my grandfather's brother, would come back here and spend winters. Now, why you live in California and come and spend your winters in Wisconsin, I don't know. But he wasn't the kind of a logical man anyway. But he was a friend of Bob La Follette, and always insisted that Bob La Follette, rather than being a progressive Republican, was a downright socialist. But as a socialist, he knew that you couldn't make any votes. And so he called himself a Republican, or a progressive Republican, as it was, I guess, later known, but that he was socialist. And Uncle M used to stay with us in the winter part of the time in the house that I have the picture on the wall there. And we would go to bed early, quite early in the evening. We had no radio and we had no TV, and you read about so long you get sleepy. And my dad would say, "Well, Uncle M, I think it's time that we all went to bed." And no, Uncle M would say, "I got a hold of the Daily Worker today, and there's a few more articles I want to read about Rushi here." It was never Russia. It was Rushi. And he was sort of contemporary with Lenin and Trotsky, and was an idealist and a visionary, and could see a government of the people for the people in his vision. And I guess for that reason, I've never been greatly conservative in my thinking. I think I started out looking at a broader view, and probably a broader historical view than you might if you just look at the immediate.
Now, the last time I interviewed you and Kate was here, you all talked about the demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. I'd like you to talk about that for a while. I think that's really the last question that I need to ask you. What happened, and what did it feel like from the inside? What were some of the conversations you had with people? Talk anywhere you want on that.
Well, I guess basically I...
Could say one more thing. I'd also like to include, if there was any conflict with your daughters and arguments you had with your daughters and, you know, disagreements that you all had where you had to make changes. Because I think the best stories are the stories where there's change. I don't know if that's in there, but if it is, I'll ask for it.
Okay. I guess being a Christian and wanting to apply Christ's principles, I find no other way of applying them and being a kind of a pacifist. I guess probably I avoid conflict, and when I do have conflict, it disturbs me a great deal. And I'm happy that I haven't had a lot of conflict in my life. But I had always taught Sunday school class, and I'm real happy that some of the people who are in our Sunday school class now were kids growing up in the Sunday school classes that I taught. And every once in a while, why, Earl Turner will say, "Well, also used to teach us in Sunday school class out to Buck Creek 25 years ago that this was true or that was true." And I have had always have put an emphasis on the fact that wars are the last resort, and there can be really no justification for an aggressive war if you have to be downtrodden enough to be to retaliate. It has to be defensive. And looking into the Vietnam War, I think I was convinced that from the beginning that it was simply a war to protect our commercial interests in the Indochina area, that we had no business being involved whatsoever other than to protect the commercial interests that our large manufacturers and large property holders had. So I felt it was wrong to threaten the lives of any of our boys simply by sending them over there to protect the interests of the large companies. And I still have the feeling that that was the motivation of the war. And I had the girls were in college, a couple of them at that time, and I'm sure you know the feeling on college campuses that this is something that the churches should be involved in. I am sure that a couple of our girls now who aren't very greatly involved in church have that feeling that when the chips are down and the church should assert itself, it didn't do it. And if there was any conflict, it was not directed at me exactly, but directed at the church. And maybe Gyneth and I represented the church because we went to the church, and maybe we didn't assert ourselves vigorously enough to try to bring the church to the point of where it opposed the war as much as it should. But and then I had taught Sunday school class down at Richland Center, a boys' Sunday school class, for a while, and then there were girls also in it. And I had always said, don't ever put down a peacemaker, because you can find 25 guys on the next block who are yelling to say, sick 'em boys, let's go to war. But you can't find very many people in a quite a radius who are willing to say, no, let's sit down and avoid war. And so I guess probably I was known pretty much as a pacifist. And the kids came home from college, and they decided that to hold a candlelight march from the campus to the, down to the Richland Center on Christmas Eve in protest of the Vietnam War. And I well remember Richard Blackburn calling me and saying, well, are you going to come down and be our speaker? We can't find any minister in town that'll go and do it. The ministers were all, actually, regardless of what their feelings were, they were actually afraid to do it because it brought too much conflict in their own churches. And I said, well, you've got me on the spot, because I have, and the girls just about said, well, Daddy, you either got to put up or shut up. That's all there is to it. This is what you've said. And so I said, yeah, I'll speak at your meeting, and I'll come and walk. And so we started at the campus, and there were, and I can remember it was a clear, cold night before Christmas, and there were probably 30 of us. And there were two or three professors from the college and their wives and children, and there were this group of college kids. Gyneth, can you remember who else was involved in that? I guess she isn't wearing an ear. But there were about 30 of us. And we had asked if we could use our church, and the minister had said, well, you can't use the church without going to the board of the trustees. And the trustee said, no, you can't use our church. And I am still very disturbed by those two or three fellows who were on the trustees at that time who refused to let us use the church for what should have been the mission of of the Christian church all over the world, and yet they refused to let us use it. But we made the march, and we sang. Somebody down the started in a chant, and I remember whoever was leading it came back and said, no, this is Christmas Eve, and this is a quiet candlelight march, and if we have any verbal, it will be carols and peace songs, but we'll have no chanting. So then we went out to the community building, and we sat around on the floor, and our minister had promised that he would come over and speak, but his rather lame excuse in later years was that he got to shoveling snow and he forgot all about it, and he didn't show up, and I was the speaker, and it was, I'm glad that I did that. I'm looking back in my life, I think that was one of the good things that I did. We were also involved in a peace march.
What year was that?
Oh, gee, I don't know. What year it might have been. Gyneth? What year was the peace march from the college? Yeah, I was thinking 69 or 70. It was while the college's youth all over were demonstrating against the war, probably in the earlier demonstrations rather than the later ones. And then we marched in the peace march, probably 4 years ago, from the library down to the new courthouse. And in that march, we had 200. And we marched all the way down and made a couple of circles around the business part of town, and I was asked to be one of the speakers of that. And somebody just very shortly before that had said that the peace movement of the America hasn't coagulated into a separate unit. It's fragmented, and it hasn't found its Gandhi. It hasn't found its leader. If there were a single leader who was inspiring, and the context of my speech was that the Christian church had found its leader 2,000 years ago, and if the Christian church in Richland Center and in America was measuring up to the standards laid down by Jesus Christ, every church in town would be in the march, and every pastor in church, rather than cringing in their basements, would be out speaking for peace. And that would broadcast over the radio the next day. So that I wasn't disappointed, it was.
So what kind of reactions have you got over the years to this kind of talking?
You mean, am I encouraged that there will be peace?
No, I mean in terms of, this is a very conservative community.
Oh.
So you've been town clerk, you're a storekeeper. Obviously, some people must get very angry at hearing something. It's one thing to hear the kids say those things, but to hear a respectable member of the community to say something like that?
I guess I am a little reluctant to speak out as loud as my conscience tells me that I should. I think probably I'm basically a pacifist, and I don't like to raise an issue, especially in this period that we've had in the last couple of weeks of the whether we were justified in dropping the bomb. I have feelings that this could have been done a great deal differently than it was, and historians are beginning to stand up and show the facts that the war was basically over before the bomb was dropped, and that we wouldn't have had to have had the invasion. And the people that say, oh, it saved 2 million lives, are justifying their dropping of the bomb when it really wasn't true that this would have happened. On the other hand, we did have the feeling that the bombings on the cities were horrible, and probably this was more horrible than even the firestorm of Dresden or the firestorm over Tokyo, which it wasn't. Each of those killed more people than either of the atomic blasts. But we were inured to that kind of tragedy and death, and we didn't feel the sufferings of those people. we were so happy that some great catastrophe, some great happening had assured the end of the war. And I guess we were happy that it was dropped. I spoke up at the Galesville Church this year and I said, there's no use of us biting ourselves in anguish at the fact that we did drop it, because we did. And I'm sure that the rest of the world will not soon forget that we were the one who did use the bomb. And certainly if we're going to literally believe the Bible, that we have to use the text that says that he who lives by the sword will die by the sword. And I'm not so sure that this wouldn't have happened. And I'm not also sure that a just God makes a greater value on 250,000 armed men as he does 250,000 women and children who died. I'm not sure that there's a balance between the two in the eyes of God. So I guess we were glad that it happened. I remember exactly the morning that it did happen. I drove into Richland Center and I met my friend Don Jewell, who was and I were quite alike in our thinking. I met him in front of the Baptist Church in the street, and we stopped our cars and walked back, and Don was quite apt to use profanity, and he said, "What in hell did we drop on them last night?" And I have remembered that all my life, that we did drop a little chunk of hell on them. And probably he characterized the action probably better than anybody else has. I'm really upset with the extremely conservative point of view that says that, well, if God wants there to be an atomic war, he'll have one, and if he wants us to be saved, why, he'll figure it out how to save it. Because I'm sure that if people don't carry out the concepts of God, that we will disintegrate. I'm not convinced of a personal devil who runs around and causes all the evil things in life, but I think mankind's spirit, and this is, I guess this is a part of my bringing up too, that what people call sin and call evil, I call the hereditary and evolutionary enlargement of our selfishness. You had to be selfish to survive. And it's a matter of our concept of survival. And Christianity exists when we supplement the emotions of survival with the emotions of compassion.
Well, see, I'm going to push you a little bit more with the question I asked before, and then I'm going to follow your line of thinking here. The question was, how did your buddies from the school years and your compatriots on the town board and your fellow teachers, Sunday school teachers in church, who did not like your peace stand, what did they say to you?
I guess that's one of the good things, unless you just enter into a direct confrontation with somebody. I'm not sure whether people put you down as a kook, or put you down as simple-minded, or put you down as an outlaw, but they don't cause you much difficulty. They don't contradict. I had to be very careful in the store, because a store isn't a pulpit. It's not something that you preach from, but you do carry on conversations with people. And you had to be a little questioning in the avenues of conversation that you followed, so that you didn't raise problems that wouldn't have existed if you hadn't raised the problem.
Now, Christianity. I have many times quoted you saying to me, and correct me if I misquoted you, that you said that For you, true religion is not when people tell each other what they ought to believe, but when people tell each other what they really do believe. And I've said that in church services when I've been asked to tell stories. You identify yourself as a Christian, and that's obviously a very important thing. Why is it? If you were raised, Islamic or Buddhist?
If I were raised Islamic or Buddhist, I probably would feel myself no less a child of God. Yes, I'm sure that that's true. Sarah preached a very interesting sermon on from Paul in Corinthians, speaking that there are neither separate Jews nor Gentiles, but they together they make up the context of humanity. You're not separated. And when we went out, I said to Sarah, "Sure liked your sermon, Sarah. Can you throw in Anwar Sadat and Malcolm X? Can you take them along with the rest of it?" And Sarah says, "I will if you will." Sarah and I understand each other. We really understand each other. We have such a close feeling as to what Christianity is, that it comes from the heart and comes from compassion and concern and the lack of putting somebody down. Katie is a Unitarian, and Katie always says that I have all the requirements of being a real good Unitarian, because we do concentrate on the philosophy of Jesus. And I have the little feeling when I go to the Unitarian church that probably this is due to my upbringing, that there's just a little something lacking. And yet if the reading for the day happens to come from the Hindu tradition or from the Muslim tradition, I have placed no less value on it than I would if it comes out of the Old Testament. I do place more value than on the Sermon on the Mount, probably than any other particular point of the Bible. I think the Sermon on the Mount is the summary of what Christianity is.